Can you test to make sure we can hear you?
Yeah, testing. Can you hear me?
Awesome. Yes, we can. Thanks. Okay, we're going to put everyone back on mute.
Okay, here we go.
Daniel, which organization are you with?
Bristol Bay Native Corporation.
Okay, we didn't have you on the list, but okay.
I heard about that.
How do you pronounce your last name, sir?
It's pronounced Chayette.
Chayette, thank you.
All right. Oh, and Romina, sure. Can you make sure you're on mute just so we don't end up with some accidental feedback issues when you're not presenting?
Could you ask him, please, to spell his last name, or do you have a
spell? Oh, I'll type it to you, Doug.
Okay, I'm going to put it back on privacy.
Good morning, committee. I'd like to go ahead and call this meeting of the Arctic Policy, Economic Development, and Tourism Committee to order at 11:03 in the a.m. Today is Tuesday, April 6, 2021. Members with us today are Representative Drummond, Representative Pocketuck, Representative Hannon, and myself, Representative Hopkins. Maybe some people might join us online or in the committee room soon, and we will identify them when they come through. Let the record show that we have a quorum to conduct business with the four of us here. Assisting us today is our recording secretary, Martha Moore, and our LIO moderator, Doug Bridges. They will join us during our committee meetings to ensure that we have accurate minutes, clear audio and video, and smooth telephonic testimony. Today's meeting will be presentations from experts in Alaska's economic development realm on the topic of the new frontier of the last frontier, economic development in modern Alaska. This week, here in Juneau, coincidentally and conveniently, the Juneau Economic Development Corporation is hosting its annual Innovation Summit, one of our state's leading events focusing on growing and diversifying Alaska's economy. Today, we will hear from three different entities: Mark Billingsley, the director of UAF's Center ICE office and the Office of Intellectual Property and Commercialization; Cindy Mittelstadt, manager of the Bristol Bay Development Fund, along with her colleagues from the Bristol Bay Native Corporation, along with Romina Benz, Polly Watson, and Daniel Chayette are available for that presentation. Finally, we will be hearing from Isaac Vanderberg, CEO of Launch Alaska, Alaska's premier business accelerator. I'd also like to note for the record that Representative Prox joined us at 11:05 in the a.m. Representative Snyder is also online in her office, and she joined at 11:04. So today, presenters will go ahead and entertain questions during the presentations. So, Representative McKay is here as well. You snuck right in. Finally, if anybody has questions during the presentations, just raise your hand, let me know, and I will stop the presentation and get the question asked. We're going to be going until 12:30 today, as about half of you are in the Transportation Committee, which starts at 1 p.m. So I'd like to go ahead and kick off the day with Mark Billingsley. Mark, please take yourself off mute, state your name and affiliation for the record, and provide your testimony or presentation.
Thank you, Representative Hopkins. Good morning, everybody. Can you hear me okay?
Absolutely, Mark. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So my name is Mark Billingsley. I am the director of Center ICE and the director of the Office of Intellectual Property and Commercialization at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. So good morning. Thanks for inviting me here today. Please interject with questions throughout. I'd like to take a little time to talk to you about the impact and opportunity of research and development, R&D, in Alaska. And then if we have time, I'd love to have a conversation around how we can strengthen this area of the economy. Go to the next slide, please. So here's what I'm planning to go over with you in my short time here today. First, I'm going to provide some context, then I'll describe the current status of what we call tech transfer in Alaska. And finally, I'll talk to you about where great opportunity lies in this area for Alaska and a little about how we can get there. Next slide, please. So as I said, my name is Mark Billingsley. I've been in Alaska for nearly 20 years. When I first arrived here, I worked for Kiewit Building Group, a large contractor. And then I went back to law school in the lower 48. We don't have any law schools up here. And came back up. And when I arrived back in Alaska, I worked as a judicial law clerk for a short period of time. And then I went to work as a trial lawyer in downtown Fairbanks for 5 years. And a little over 5 years ago, I transitioned over to the University of Alaska Fairbanks. At UAF, I'm the director of Center ICE and the Office of Intellectual Property and Commercialization, like I said. I'm also a registered patent attorney. Is a registration you have with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. I'm one of only a small handful of patent attorneys in Alaska, perhaps, or at least to my knowledge, there are only two of us total. Status of IP, intellectual property development in Alaska. It tells you where there's great opportunity for growth, and I'm not talking about the attorneys, I'm talking about development of the IP. And growth and innovation is a theme that'll run throughout what I'm going to talk about today. So UAF research, I'm here to talk about the impact of an opportunity of research and development in Alaska. I am going to focus on UA research because that's where I come from, and especially UAF research because that's what I know best, and UAF is where most of the research is performed, but certainly there are other research and development being performed in private industry as well. So my primary purpose here today is not to boast about UAF research. It is helpful, though, to understand where UAF research fits into the landscape of things. UAF really is a significant research institute. You ought to check out the rankings of U.S. research institutes, and it's not like we're sitting right there next to Johns Hopkins and MIT and the University of Michigan, but we're in a very respectable place, especially considering the size of our population, and we truly are the leader in Arctic research. I can provide you with all kinds of stats on UF research if you'd like, but really where I help out with research is the impact of it. So we all want our research to have a positive social impact and a positive economic impact. That's where my office helps out. Go to the next slide. Thanks. All right, so I'm going to describe what I do. I'm not going to go into great detail, but to help you understand this instrument of the economy. And it's all about achieving economic and social impact of research. So in this graphic, you can see the concept of turning research into reality. Researchers have ideas represented as the light bulbs on that conveyor belt there, and they apply for grants, which bring them into that machine there in the middle, and that's where they build out the idea by creating prototypes or doing testing or whatever. And then on the other side, you can see the products that come out. And I exist in that narrow but important slice between the research machine and the real world implementation. So I would be in that little vertical oval you can see there on the graphic. Without my office, the research outputs could be left on a shelf in a journal article that few people read, or just as were some the Tesla or General Electric could read that journal article and they could make a bunch of money off of it. So my job is to capture that value and make sure the public actually benefits from the university's research. So how do we do that? the steps along this arrow describe the process. We identify the inventions, and then we research the market and see what it looks like for that kind of technology, and then we research the prior art, make sure it's actually novel or a new thing. And if all signs are go, then we'll protect it, the intellectual property, such as with a patent, and then try to find a private partner that can bring the technology to the market. The university obviously isn't in the business of building widgets and developing technology to bring it to the market. So we try to license the technology to the private partner. So basically, my office sets things up so that industry partners have the opportunity to use the university's inventions, and then they can go on to maximize the economic and social impact of the research.
Mr. Billingsley, we have a question from Representative Hannon.
Absolutely.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Billingsley, on the arrow it says, search for prior art. And I'm able to follow the arrow, but can you tell me, is that a term specific to patent law, or is it, search for prior art, and I know that patent applications require all kinds of schematics and drawings, so is that what you're referring to, or is there a specific phrasing there that you can teach us today?
Thanks for calling me out on my use of the technical term. I should have taken that out of there. It's the legal term, especially in the field of patent law, and it's talking about anything that's been published that already describes the invention. So it could be a prior patent, or it could be somebody marketed and tried to sell this back in the 1970s, and that actually counts as prior. The definition of prior art, as defined in federal law, is really broad. But basically, the idea is, does this already exist in the world?
Mr. Billingsley, a follow-up?
Nope.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Billingsley, this is Rep. Hopkins. I have a question. In terms of identifying these technologies and projects that are happening at UA System across the state, do you go out and look at what's happening? Do people submit ideas to you? How does that process work? Who starts that identifying the technology? Do they come to you, or do you go to them more?
Yeah. More is probably, we go to them. It's probably about 50-50. We do a lot of outreach, which is going and talking to all the new faculty when they come in, all the new grad students when they come in. And we need to make sure that they're aware of our services, because we don't know when the light bulb goes off in their head and they have a new idea. They need to be aware of us, so they come to us when the time comes. It's a challenge. So it's a constantly educating people about what we do.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. So, Tanya, if you go to the next slide. So here's an example of how that process can work, of commercializing university research. So some years ago, a UAF grad student designed a reactor. We figured out that it was new, and we thought there was some market potential to it, so we applied for a patent. Patents take 2 to 3 years, generally. And during that time, we looked for an industry partner, but we really didn't find anyone who was interested. Nothing much really happened with this. Fortunately, though, one of our one of our programs connected the inventor with an entrepreneur, and they started talking about it. And the entrepreneur was pretty interested, but still they weren't sure how they might go about commercializing it. So they literally spent 3 months talking to over 100 potential customers, and they gathered a ton of feedback. And ultimately, they pivoted to using the reactor to treat PFAS contaminated materials. And some of you may know, probably do know, that PFAS is a particularly big problem in Alaska.
Representative Hannon has a question.
Thank you, through the chair. I happen to be one of those Alaskans working on PFAS and solutions for my district. So this Aqua Aga is a reactor that treats contaminated PFAS material?
That's right. I'd love to connect you with them. Yeah.
My staff will be calling you shortly, because it turns out agencies basically say there aren't many solutions. So.
Right. So they are getting federal contracts quickly. There is no standard way to do it. Basically, dump it on a barge and ship it out is the solution right now. It's not a great option.
Yeah,
especially when you're rural Alaska.
Right, or in follow-up in Fairbanks last summer, where they tested some incineration of it, but the results are not very health focused if you were down plume from that test.
So you're familiar, this is a big problem. It's what contaminated the drinking water in North Pole. Yeah. This is a totally Alaska-grown company. It's high-tech. There's people all across the world who are working on this challenge. We've got a potential legitimate solution and company right here in our own backyard. It's still not easy, and they've got a long way to go, but I think we all would agree that we really would want this company to succeed and capture some market share. These are high-quality jobs that they're creating, and this is entirely new revenue that they're bringing into Alaska. Next slide, please. So here's another example that really demonstrates the challenges and the long time frame associated with building these technology-based, research-based startups and why we need commitment and patience. To my knowledge, Alaska has never produced an FDA-approved pharmaceutical. Somebody please let me know if they know differently, but I don't know of any drug that has been developed at in the state of Alaska. And that's still the case as far as I know. But UAF spinoff company Be Cool Pharmaceutics is probably closer than anyone in Alaska has ever been. They've still got a long ways to go, though. So UAF researcher formed her own company, and she's working with some industry partners to start navigating the bureaucracy and testing requirements of the FDA. And we've all heard about how the COVID vaccines were approved by the FDA in record time, and that is so true. It normally takes more like 10 years. And if you're not solving a global pandemic, it still does take like 10 years.
Mr. Billingsley, this is Representative Hopkins, is this the research that has been spurred by the ground squirrel hibernation?
Exactly, that's right. So this is built on decades of research into hibernation, which is unique, very Alaska, right? And then developing a chemical compound based on that research, and then figuring out how it can be applied to humans, potentially, hopefully, that would be phase two trials, right? And the idea is you could help people who have suffered a spinal cord or a brain injury and get them transported to a hospital before the processes that result in paralysis really set in. So, again, this company has a long way to go, but they're doing some great work, and there's some real interest around the country from the federal government. It really demonstrates how hard it can be, though. It requires a lot of patience and long-term commitment, and they've got a lot of hurdles to overcome. And it takes an entire ecosystem to support a company like this. And the truth is that in this case, Alaska just doesn't have all those parts of the ecosystem, so they have had to go outside because they couldn't look internally for even investors who are savvy enough to guide a company like this through the FDA approval process. But we need to be doing all that we can to build and support the ecosystem that does support companies like this. And that requires researchers and industry partners and entrepreneurs and investors and Ms. Middlestead, who's on the line here, and Isaac's Launch Alaska Accelerator. It's all part of this ecosystem that really is important to strengthening or to having more companies like this. Next slide, please. All right, so let's put this all in perspective. I'm talking to you about technology development and commercialization. You know, there's this show, Silicon Valley. I've actually never seen it. And you hear about this small company named Moderna in Boston that just used mRNA to help save the world economy from total collapse. And how does Alaska fit into all this? Because Alaska's not Boston, and Alaska's not Silicon Valley. And similarly, the University of Alaska doesn't have the history, the centuries of experience building up a research enterprise that you'll find at powerhouses like Stanford and Michigan and the University of Washington. But we've got the seeds of a strong startup community here in Alaska, and we do have a very strong research and development operation at the University of Alaska. So looking past Boston and Silicon Valley, we have some aspirational peers. Boise, Idaho, for example, and Oregon State University in Corvallis are doing great, and they provide instructive models for us to learn from. And I would note that Silicon Valley, home to so many tech startup companies, has Stanford and UC Berkeley and UC San Francisco, and they'd all say that Silicon Valley wouldn't be there without those strong universities grounding them. And likewise, Boston has MIT and Harvard and many other schools. So innovation rarely thrives in isolation. Universities rarely explode with innovation and entrepreneurialism unless the community shares the same values and mindset. And the reverse is true as well. Next slide, please. So what can we do to spur more innovation and entrepreneurialism? I can start by telling you what I'm doing. A couple of years ago, we started Center ICE, the Center for Innovation, Commercialization, and Entrepreneurship. I was talking before about Office of Intellectual Property and Commercialization, but that's really just a tool for getting research out the door. I need to make sure that that tool is operating effectively, but I can't control which inventions come to me because I'm not a researcher, and I can't control whether they have commercial potential. I need a lot of inventions, and I need to make sure that they actually align with real-world needs. So we created Center ICE at UAF, and it's a statewide, it serves statewide all of University of Alaska, and it has multiple public programs open to the public. And the idea was to ensure that there were more innovations with commercial potential coming out of Alaska. So, for example, I need people to license our technology, too. So we created a program that's building more entrepreneurs. And we've got a program that helps align research with industry needs and connects researchers with industry. And we've got a program creating more early-stage investors who could invest in these startup companies. These programs might sound kind of all over the place, but really they're all needed at various steps along the path to commercialization. They're part of this ecosystem or community that I'm talking about that we really need. I should also mention here that I actually just lost a position in my office due to the university budget cuts. So our growth and success is going to be stunted. We're not a large office, but still we're doing the best and we're covering it and we're pivoting internally as needed. Next slide, please. So where we're going in terms of my opinion, at least, I don't think it's a question of whether we're going to make progress. We're going to. It's just how much. Conservatively, my office has only been around for a few years, and we're getting better at what we do each day. And this will continue, and we'll continue with steady and slow growth. Federal agencies are putting more pressure on the commercialization side of research. We're slowly building more programs, and the same goes for non-university R&D in Alaska. And the startup trend in Seattle and elsewhere will continue moving up here into Alaska. But we can really kickstart this process by making it a priority, and some of the actions don't even require money. I believe we just have to have a vision for where we want to get to and commit to it and then make a plan and execute. I'd really like to see, for example, a real venture capital firm based in Alaska, investing in Alaska companies. And I'd like to see a university spinoff that exits through an IPO. And we should have multiple startups in Alaska that have each created 100 plus new jobs, high quality jobs, and brought entirely new revenue into Alaska. We need you all as legislators, not only to share that vision, but to own that vision and to lead it. Next slide, please. I think that this is my last slide. What else needs to be done at the top of my list is please just know that this is going on, and bring it back to your district. Be aware. Make sure that we have a place at the table during important discussions. Next is make this an integral part of your vision for Alaska. On the policy front, there are multiple policy initiatives that legislatures take to encourage innovation in their states. I get a weekly newsletter that highlights some of these. I quickly searched and found the Federal Reserve has a paper on this topic. Many economists have looked at this issue. So there are multiple studies, multiple reports on best practices and policy options, and I'm happy to pull those up and send you guys them. A few smaller ideas that I've seen work in other states in the academic context, SBIR matching. So SBIRs are small grants starting at $150,000 that the federal government gives to small businesses that are developing technology. Some states match those grants 1-to-1 or less, even just 1/4-to-1. Basically, the states are relying on the federal agency's expertise to identify which companies have the most promising technology, and then the states provide a little extra funding. And then with those with the matching funding, they can also tie them into accelerators and incubators and provide these wraparound services that really nurture these companies into existence. I was talking to the folks from Hawaii, and they were saying that they started with a really small allocation from their state legislature, and it's been successful. So the legislature's chosen to give them to expand it. And I mean, by small, I mean, I'm thinking they said something like $300,000. Another thing is support for building a pre-seed fund. This is really early stage capital that's so important for companies, but it's not available from banks. So it's not too hard to attract $75,000 to build an app if you live in Silicon Valley, but Alaska startups don't have the same access to easy access to capital.
Mr. Billingsley, Representative Prox had a question.
Sure, please.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair. I understand you've only been in business for a few years, did you say?
Yes.
Okay, and follow up. The object of the game, this is definitely risk capital, but the object of the game is to eventually become self-funding, I'm assuming.
So I'm at the university, and if you're talking about like a financial model for my office at the university, is that what you're talking about, or talking about like a fund?
For your office at the university, yes.
Oh, okay. That's sort of a policy decision to be made by people who are above, it's above my pay grade to make that decision, mm-hmm. but that is the model at some universities, and other universities use their office like mine differently, and that's not their objective.
Okay. And what is your contact information?
It is.
It's on the next slide, Representative.
Oh, it's on the next one. Okay. Yeah. Well, I don't know that I have this slideshow, or they're out of order. Anyway, all right, we can get that. Never mind.
Okay.
Certainly. I have a question, quick question, Mr. Billingsley, before we finish up here. The recent advances in polymer fracking that's up on the slope, that's been in partnership with Hillcorp and the University Research. Is that something that's been in touch with your organization and in your office?
Yeah, so the Petroleum Department has non-disclosure agreements in place with some of the companies that are operating on the North Slope in that context. So the answer is yes. So I'm talking about one of the economic impacts of research. I approach it from a certain perspective, but there's this whole other aspect of just researchers helping the corporations figure out their problems, and that could be sponsored research. But the answer is yes, and the non-disclosure agreements do go through my office. So yeah, and I hope that inventions come out of that, and then we're able to work with those companies that are working on the North Slope to commercialize those. Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
All right, so a pre-seed fund, I think that would be a great thing for Alaska. Often the economics don't pencil out for those, so they're often such the way they do for a big venture capital fund, so they're often supported by local government or universities or economic foundations or economic development organizations. Last thing I have on this list here is entrepreneurs in residence. They're experienced entrepreneurs who you can place at a university, and they really bring their culture and their attitude and their way of thinking into a university. They can really shake things up. They're scrappy and young and hungry and fast moving and risk averse, and they don't fit in with the university that well sometimes. So they really, I mean, they do, but it's not the normal culture at a university. So they can really shake things up, and it can be really interesting and fun. So having one of those positions at the university would be great. And then quick final note is that we're all stakeholders in this. So state government, state legislature, local government, ARTRs, corporate partners, university, we all have a role to play here. So that is what I have for a presentation here today. I think I've gone over my time, so I'm not even going to wrap up. I'd just like to answer any questions if there are any. And please reach out to me if you have any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Billingsley. Are there any questions in wrap up? Does not look like it. Thank you very much for your presentation today and for your work up at the university and trying to diversify our economy and get some of those wonderful research efforts going and out into the market. Thank you very much, Mr. Billingsley. Next up, we will have the Bristol Bay Native Corporation, BBNC, presented by Cindy Middlestadt, Romina Benz, Polly Watson and Daniel, whose name I lost here, Chayette.
Chayette.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you very much, Cindy. Please go ahead and put yourself on the record with your affiliation and proceed with your presentation.
All right. Good morning, everyone. Good morning to my colleagues. For the record, I'm Cindy Middlestat, the fund manager for the Bristol Bay Development Fund, a wholly owned subsidiary of the Bristol Bay Native Corporation. Tanya, if you could advance the slide by one to the land acknowledgement, please. I want to begin first with the land acknowledgement by thanking the Aleutic, the Supiak, Dena'ina, Tenaina, Yupik, and the Yupiak peoples of Bristol Bay. We recognize the thousands of years of stewardship and acknowledge the people of the region as they continue to be the caretakers of the land. On to the next slide. So to my representative Hopkins and each of the distinguished committee members present today, as I mentioned, I'm Cindy Middlestat, manager of the Bristol Bay Development Fund, a wholly owned subsidiary of the Bristol Bay Native Corporation, and one of two in-region initiatives to invest in Bristol Bay. Later in this presentation, you'll hear from Romina Bentz, senior manager of SBA programs, and Polly Watson, SBA analyst, who will talk about the second in-region initiative. On to the next slide. The purpose of the Bristol Bay Development Fund is to be a catalyst for the in-region business startup, survival, success, and growth through effective deployment of both financial and non-financial capital. The fund offers financial capital in the form of micro-equity, that is investments in the range of $1,000 to $10,000, equity, debt, and convertible debt, and we're also receptive to other financing structures. Our maximum investment is $500,000, and the fund is able to invest in businesses located in Bristol Bay, and we can invest in businesses outside the Bristol Bay, so long as that business offers a significant social and economic benefit to the residents of Bristol Bay. When I joined the fund in 2017, I evaluated and kind of did a strategic reset of the organization. And there were three focus areas that I designed that guide the work we're doing today. The first is to offer a broader range of tiered products, whereby businesses who are unfamiliar with credit have an entry point to access capital, while we continue to meet businesses at other stages of growth as well. Expand our investing approach. And third, enhance our marketing efforts. On to the next slide, please. On screen, you see a number of ways that we have been building our portfolio of non-financial support in the recent few years. And for the times we are in, I included our COVID task force in this portfolio of support. Coincidentally, BBNC recently conducted a survey of shareholders on a number of topics, including small business. Of the 2,700 shareholders who responded to this survey, 55% of those respondents identified they are interested in starting a business. 22% of that population responded that they are highly interested in starting a business. 49% of those in that respondent group identified that writing a business plan is a barrier. 42% responded that they identify a need for financial planning. 41% identify a need for support and connections. And 40% identify a need for choosing the right business structure. And all this is in addition to probably the number one need is capital. So, the positive in this is that the portfolio of financial support that you see on screen now actually closely mirrors the ways and the efforts that what each of our companies present here today is doing to break these barriers. A few specific examples to demystify the business planning process, the fund sponsors subscriptions to a product called Live Plan. And Live Plan is a cloud-based product that offers more than 200 business plan templates for company owners to develop their financial model and craft all the components of the business plan. Another element that I want to point out in this portfolio of non-financial support is the introduction of Path to Prosperity, which is a business plan competition, and it addresses many of the barriers identified that I just shared with you from our survey as well, in addition to an opportunity for winning companies to obtain seed money. The business directory is also used to showcase shareholder-owned businesses on social media channels, in corporate newsletters, and to connect other shareholder-owned businesses for new opportunities or partnerships. So in short, the fund serves as a hub to connect what's disconnected and is intended to leverage Alaska's expansive network of practitioners, mentors, niche expertise, accelerators, innovation programs like Mark spoke of, facilitating introductions and supporting infrastructure projects and much more. Next slide, please. About 2 years ago, Bristol Bay Development Fund partnered with Spruce Root, a community lending entity located in Juneau, to blueprint Path to Prosperity, a business plan competition that they designed. Path to Prosperity offers a structure for individuals to pitch business ideas, obtain business training, and receive business planning support that for three businesses leads to prize money to use towards business readiness. Our partnership brings together two like-minded entities to stimulate economic development and create resilient companies at the onset of business planning. There are three distinct components of the business plan competition. The business boot camp, at which 10 to 12 finalists are selected from a pool of applicants by an independent panel of judges to attend a multi-day compressed business education boot camp. The second silo in this phase of three is the competition features a total of $50,000 in grant capital to three winning business plans selected by another panel of judges. And this the winners are selected from the finalists who complete boot camp and submit their competitive business plans. Two winning companies receive $20,000 each, and a third winning company receives $10,000. The grant is used to fund business objectives that advance the company's business readiness or growth. These can include marketing or branding activities, including website designs, specialty training, legal advising, creating accounting systems, and even equipment purchases. The last of the three program components in Path to Prosperity is the business advising. This is a series of coaching sessions with company owners for a period of 1 year or more following the financial awards to hear about company milestones, offer a safe space for businesses to share their challenges, and identify supportive resources. Our pivots to the program this year included substituting a virtual boot camp for a place-based boot camp. We provided stipends to finalists to defray internet expenses, and we hosted additional work sessions following boot camp but before the business plan deadline. And we extended the deadline this year to submit business plans too. Next slide. And this one, do you see a list of eligibility criteria on screen, or do you see one?
We see them all now.
Okay. So the P2P competition you can see then on screen is open to individuals. It's the tinkerer who may have an invention. It's an individual who has a concept and can identify basic revenue streams. It's also open to existing businesses who identify a growth strategy, tribal enterprises, and business concepts that are located outside the region but can demonstrate or intend to have a significant operating presence in Bristol Bay.
Ms. Middlestadt, I have a quick question. This is Representative Hopkins.
Sure.
The fund itself, where does the fund seed money come from, and how is it the earnings spent, or is the fund itself spent? So is it more of a sustainable fund where the earnings are appropriated out each year, or is it more of an allocation from a specific entity to support those applicants?
Sure, good question. It is more of an allocation. Bristol Bay Native Corporation seeded $5 million to this fund, and the earnings, if you will, from investments are intended to further shareholder dividends and continue to perpetuate the economic vibrancy of the region and the shareholder.
Thank you very much.
All right. So Path to Prosperity, the program is constructed on three pillars: the people, profit, and planet. The boot camp spends a significant amount of time exploring the intersection of this triple bottom line philosophy, and it uses metrics to capture a company's social or ecological benefits. And my intent on screen was just to show you an illustration that we get to the heart of this early on in the application process. So you're going to hear a reveal of how the winning businesses intend to meet their stewardship duties in a video montage shortly. Next slide. So the collective impacts of Path to Prosperity in just the two cycles that the program has been delivered are And they're enumerated on screen there as well. 63 applications were submitted representing new business concepts, innovations, or business expansion opportunities from 15 Bristol Bay communities. 22 company owners have attended a sponsored boot camp. 11 companies took advantage of our sponsored live plan subscriptions. And with our most recent set of awards, now equaling 6, these companies have received a cumulative $100,000 in investment for their startup or growth initiatives.
Ms. Middlestead, we have a question from Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. Ms. Middlestead, when did it start? When was the first awardee?
We started this program in, so we're in 2021, 2019. And our cycles are long. It probably didn't, that doesn't come out well, but we start with a application round where we go out and implement a call for all ideas, all business concepts, and we just want them at their just initial thought. They've thought through a basic revenue stream. They've identified a need in the community. They complete the application, and then a panel of judges will whittle these down to identify the top 10 or top 12 who will proceed on to boot camp. And then the funnel continues. Those who complete boot camp and submit their business plans then are judged in a second round. And from that round, the three winners are selected.
Have one follow-up?
Follow-up.
Do you have a sense yet, through the chair, whether our COVID year has derailed people in your awardee process, or has it given them more time to think about new ways and creativity coming out of the dark ages?
Sure. Kind of got two answers for that. We did experience kind of a different cohort this year in our Path to Prosperity. Last year, 10 finalists attended the boot camp and all 10 submitted business plans, so a very competitive cohort. This year, coming out of boot camp, there were 10 companies, and we did have some attrition for the right reasons, however, and then 5 of the 10 submitted business plans. So very competitive and had, I would say, more marked readiness milestones going into it as well. So it's hard to determine if COVID played a role in that based on what I know of the company owners, or if it was just an atypical year. And I often consult with my colleagues at Spruce Root too, because they have been at this for, I think, 9 cycles now, so almost 9 years. And they have had atypical years, so it's hard to predict or determine that, even with COVID.
Sure.
But I always think about quality as well. So when people have their, company owners have their own insights or aha moments and change direction, that's absolutely okay as well. So,
yeah.
Thank you very much. Please proceed.
Sure. And then just kind of a second response to that as well. Anecdotally, you know, working through COVID this year, and even as we're coming into recovery now, I would say I've had more calls and more interest in business ideas as well. So from that perspective, I think there's an uptick. And that's just kind of, again, anecdotally, but I feel there's an uptick in that small business startup and or some thinking about growth and or pivots.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
So this is where I'm going to pause and ask for support to play our video. You're going to hear from the three winning companies in this video montage.
Looks like it's rocking and rolling on our end. Thank you.
Okay.
Eliminate some of the space you were envisioning.
Thank you much, Ms. Middleset. That video played well on our end.
Awesome. Thank you. So at this time, I'm going to transition to Romina Benz and Polly Watson, and then Dan Cheyenne is on standby for any questions we may have regarding infrastructure projects that I'll talk about near the end.
Thank you much, Ms. Middleset.
Thank you.
Good morning, committee members. My name is Romina Benz. I am the Small Business Administration Senior Program Manager. I am responsible for BB&C's government contracting compliance. In 2014, BB&C's Board of Directors directed management to find innovative ways to invest in Bristol Bay. BB&C launched its in-region government contracting initiative. The program is an in-house mentor protege program that offers village corporations in the Bristol Bay region with federal contracting mentorship, training, and joint venture opportunities. The primary goal is to build a knowledge baseline and develop best practices to position a village corporation for growth and success in the SBA 8A program. Additional goals are to utilize BB&C's subsidiary capacity and also provide mentorship that is mutually profitable to BB&C, tribes, and village corporations in its region. The program is not a guarantee of a joint venture with a BB&C subsidiary. The relationship has to make business sense for both BB&C and the participant in our IGC program. So BB&C provides training, strategic planning, and templates to use as a guide, such as operating agreements, delegation of authority, policies and procedures. We want our village corporations to have a good, solid corporate governance foundation in place before they enter into government contracting. Next slide, please. So each village corporation and tribe have their own unique challenges. However, they all face the common challenge of geographic isolation. Other challenges include internet availability, reliable internet availability. Government contracting is also very heavily regulated, and sometimes it can be extremely difficult for village corporations to find skilled managers or staff locally. Typically, there is little or no access to or exposure to business concepts and practices. My colleague Polly Watson is going to go through the next two slides.
Thank you, Romina. So since the
Ms. Watson, if you could just put yourself on the record so that we can track who's talking on our end.
Hi, this is Polly Watson.
Excellent, thank you. Please proceed.
Since the inception of the initiative, we've had a total of 9 village corporations and tribes participate in the program. The program is typically about a year long. When a participant is close to graduating the program, we'll do an assessment, and based off of the assessment, we'll mutually agree to extend the participation agreement or not. And in 2018, BB&C sold its majority interest in one of the construction line of companies, Bristol Industries, to Chogyung Limited, a Dillingham village corporation. BB&C looks forward to continuing our work to identify unique economic development opportunities in Bristol Bay. This historic partnership demonstrates the potential value the in-region government contracting initiative can bring to the Bristol Bay corporations. Next slide, please. In February, we conducted a 3 half-day virtual trainings for all IGC participants and business leaders. Starting this month, we will be doing monthly 1 to 2 hour virtual trainings for the remaining of the year. And BB&C continues to provide mentorship, corporate governance training, and strategic planning, and provide templates as user guides to help build that corporate governance foundation. And BB&C continues, as this program goes, we see that we navigate challenges on a need-to-need basis, and this program is a lot of work, and it is fluid, so we continue to refine the program. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Watson. Are there any questions for her on that presentation? One thing I have, this is Representative Hopkins. What are some of the changes you're looking at making to as you continue to develop this project?
Do you want me to answer that, Polly? That's a good question. It varies depending on the participant. Some of our participants are more sophisticated than others. So we do partner with a consulting company, Transcend Strategic Consulting, and working with them, we are able to utilize their skills in being able to determine where the program needs to be directed according to the participant. So it's very subjective.
Excellent. Thank you. And for the record, that was Romina Benz with that answer. Thank you very much. Please, please proceed with your next slide and next presenter.
All right. So back to myself. This is Cindy Middlestead on the record again. And next slide should read on the horizon. So concluding back to Bristol Bay Development Fund and working forward, we intend to conduct an evaluation of our Path to Prosperity program. Identify any opportunities to improve or pivot in light of what we've learned in the last two cycles. We will continue to follow all the winners and the finalists, so that's about 25 companies total, to monitor their business readiness and or access to credit. We have a couple of infrastructure projects as well that our companies are nurturing. The first is an infrastructure project on the horizon, and that is a recent award to BBNC in the amount of $99,000 for a tribal energy development capacity grant. This grant will be used to define organizational options that would allow smaller Bristol Bay utilities to share essential resources and personnel, and thereby improve each utility's reliability and reduce local power costs. And the second project that we're following and or supporting in Southwest Alaska also is the support of tribal entities to advance tribal spectrum broadband implementation projects. Last slide. When asked to kind of identify what support we might ask of this committee, I wanted to kind of lead off with hindsight and how we go forward. We knew that at the early stage of federal legislation to develop economic relief packages, an ad hoc network of regional fund managers and practitioners met to brainstorm ways we could leverage our collective talents to support businesses in our respective regions. None of our entities alone met the minimum asset size to be approved SBA lenders for the purpose of administering the PPP or the EIDL funds. However, what we could envision was a concept of a statewide network to develop an outreach and deployment model for ongoing and future economic disruptions or emergencies. This might include consulting and or contracting with regional fund operators for outreach and deployment of the American Rescue Plan Act resources, support or see the design of a statewide economic continuity network that could evaluate, identify, and invest in a unified cloud-based platform for all entities to assess deployment in a defined region, potentially lend aid in ARD and the American Rescue Act deployment through loaned executives, access to niche expertise, perform outreach and support or enhance a community navigator program. So with that, I conclude my remarks. Quiana.
Thank you very much, Ms. Middlestead, for that presentation. And I urge you to reach out to our offices as well and any of us in the legislature and let us know about the ways we can look into those ARPA funds, those rescue package funds, to see if there's an opportunity for that for business development and entrepreneurship going forward. Thank you very much for your presentation. Are there any closing questions for Ms. Middlestead or the Bristol Bay Development Corporation or Native Corporation? Does not look like it, so thank you very much again for your presentation and your time today, and very informative for us all. Next up, we have Launch Alaska here to discuss the efforts that they're taking across the state as well to implement and expand economic diversity. All right, so thank you very much, and we have Mr. Vanderberg up. Mr. Vanderberg, please put yourself on the record and proceed with your presentation as well.
Hi, everyone, and thank you, Representative Hopkins and other members of the committee for inviting me to present. And my name is Isaac Vandenberg. I am CEO of Launch Alaska, and I'm going to jump into it here. I have a bunch of slides to run through, and so thanks, Tanya, for helping me get through these here. So to the team slide, like I said, I'm the CEO of Launch Alaska. We have a small but fierce team. Just a kind of theme in terms of the background on the team of interest. More than half of our team comes from oil and gas, which I think you'll find interesting as we get into further into the presentation. We also come from corporates like Google also from folks like ABB, which is a large power electricity supply OEM as well. Okay, next slide. So Launch Alaska is a nonprofit that supports the development of projects by compressing the time, proximity, and focus to forge productive relationships and identify opportunities to deploy solutions. Basically, our strategy is recognize that there is a lot of innovation and research and exciting young companies out there, and we are trying to partner them with Alaska asset owners like utilities, municipalities, infrastructure owners of all stripes to deploy solutions quickly and to help grow companies and create bolster our local economy. So it's basically like, you know, pointing the fire hose of innovation at some of Alaska's most intractable problems. Next slide. Our mission is to accelerate the resource revolution by deploying game-changing technologies. What the heck does that mean? If we go to the next slide here. So there are several challenges that are global and also very relevant to Alaska. Climate change is disrupting everything from the seafood industry to electrical infrastructure that's starting to bend and sway on the North Slope to, you know, ice roads, and really it's a real-time emergency for the state. Alaska also has the second highest cost of energy in the U.S., and depending on the year, either the highest or close to highest per capita consumption of energy, which is a tough 1-2 punch to both have high cost of energy and high consumption. There's also local economic headwinds. So even pre-COVID, Alaska was facing some tough times ahead due to the price of oil and production of oil. And now that COVID has added on additional challenges around tourism also added further impacts on production of oil, we're in for some tough times as a state. But Alaska also has an untapped potential to lead the resource revolution and to become a new kind of energy state. And we see that there's a massive opportunity confronting us as a state if we're willing and have the courage to embrace it. Next slide.
Mr. Vandenberg, we had a question from Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. Only because I've never seen it phrased that way, but we're the second highest cost of energy in the U.S. Who's the first? Is that Hawaii?
Yeah. So either Hawaii or Connecticut, surprisingly. That's who we kind of go toe-to-toe with. You know? And we have a very close relationship with Hawaii, which I can talk about a little bit further in the presentation.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. And so the opportunity in front of us, we think Alaska is already a world-class deployment ground for technologies that decarbonize and electrify energy, transportation, food, and water systems. There's also a really exciting opportunity right now with the global declining cost curves around renewables, storage, and other distributed technologies, which beckons Alaska in a really big way. And there's also a global transition to microsystems, which is kind of a Launch Alaska word here, I think. But basically, the idea that food, water, transportation, energy systems are all getting smaller and smaller, and instead of having big, you know, big global systems that are liable for to be disrupted and set astray by things like pandemics or ships parking themselves in the Suez Canal or increasing severity of storms. That these systems are beginning to turn into microgrids or to local food distribution systems or local resilient water utilities that can take a beating but still get up and running the next day. So the whole world is moving towards islanded solutions or distributed solutions. And guess what? Alaska has over 250 communities who already have decades of expertise in developing islanded food, water, transportation, energy systems. So next slide. So like I said before, there's four areas we focus in on. Food, next slide. Water, next slide. Transportation, next slide. And energy. On each of those slides, those are our portfolio companies that we have worked with over the past 3 years. And you can see it's weighted pretty heavily toward energy. That's where we've had the largest share of our companies. And what we do as a program is we recruit startups from anywhere in the world, and we run them through basically a 8-month Shark Tank program where panelists like Cindy, who's on the line, thank you, Cindy, and folks through ASAP and Center Ice, Mark and his team, they participate as panelists, and they look at all of these companies over the course of 8 months, and they select ones that they think are a good fit for Alaska. And ones that aren't, go home, and ones that are, stay on for the next session. And by the time we're done with the 8-month process, we basically have, you know, out of an initial pool of, say, 40 or 50 companies, we'll get it down to 7 or 8 that then become part of our portfolio. So on the next slide, Pam is going to give you a better explanation of our program than I ever could. So if we can play the video there, Tanya.
Thank you very much, Mr. Vandenberg. That video played well from our end.
Okay. And so the tech deployment track is really the bread and butter of Launch Alaska. This is our main program where, as I said, we recruit companies from anywhere and kind of filter through them and hope to end up with a few companies that can join our portfolio at the end of the program. Just stepping back for 1 minute, one of the learnings we've had as an organization since we got started in 2016 is that what the world's most exciting startups need, and what I would argue is kind of Alaska's role in the global innovation world, is what they really need is proof that their technology works and traction in a real world setting. We ourselves manage a couple of small investment funds, and we're partnering with with a really exciting venture capital fund. It's going to be Alaska's first really large, serious VC fund. And we're excited about the financing side of things for the companies. But if you really talk to the companies themselves, what they need is not so much the funding and the financing, but rather real projects, real relationships with customers, real relationships with utilities to show that their technologies work, that they can perform as advertised, and that they can show that, you know, their technologies can make their way through an Alaska winter and still be up and running in the spring. And from there, they can go raise additional funding rounds or go to much larger markets. So the whole point of the tech deployment track is to try to help companies make real relationships with real asset owners in the state and deploy their solutions in steel in the ground projects. And from there, these companies go off and become, impactful world-class firms. So next slide. So it's a great group of folks that we have as panelists in our program. These are the folks that help us choose the companies, and we couldn't do what we do without them. You'll see Cindy there on this. We also have folks from AEA, from McKinney Capital, Ron over there from C-Alaska, folks from ASRC and Solid Waste Services, and then also from the university, researchers. So it's really a mix of investors, researchers, private folks, public folks. Office of Indian Energy is there with Givi. Next slide. And more folks, you probably recognize quite a few of them. Anthony there from C-Alaska and Shana from the municipality. If you see a little logo, a Launch Alaska logo on the picture, that means that they're part of our external review committee. And these are folks who, before the companies even get into our program, these folks are experts and technical experts in their fields. And what they do is basically vet all of the applicants to make sure that the claims the companies are making are scientifically, or even theoretically feasible. So we're basically looking for them. You know, a good example is a company applied to our program a couple of years ago that I loved from a financial or investment perspective. And I also saw a huge market for them in Alaska and globally, and I was really excited about the companies. And then one of the folks from the university, actually ASAP, pulled me aside and said, "Hey, Isaac, just so you know, this violates the second law of thermodynamics, and it can never work." And so I said, "Oh, well, thank you. That's good to know." And that's really the role the ERC plays, is trying to keep junk effectively from making its way into our program and being deployed and causing a lot of damage. And we take that role really seriously. We really want to vet companies so that by the time we get a project done, we're not, peddling false wares, so to speak. Next slide. Okay, so the companies come through our program. And as I said before, the whole goal is to get them traction and real relationships with Alaskan asset owners. So what we have now developed in the last 24 months, as we recognize that what the companies really want is traction and access to real customers and real partners in Alaska, is we've developed an innovation partnership program where we're partnering with some of those same asset owners to help them source innovation to solve their own problems. And so we have a four-step process here that we engage in some of these asset owners with, where we facilitate through a collaborative process. We make a plan together. We deploy some technology or some suite of technologies, and then we measure the impact. And that last step is really important. So one of our staff members, Frances Ball, who has a background at Google, she is great about measuring the impact in ESG reporting, environmental, social, and governance reporting on all the projects that we do. And then we take that very seriously, which I'll talk about here a little bit later. So next slide. So we've gotten these companies through our TDT program. They've found projects, and our goal as an organization is to facilitate $1 billion of projects in Alaska by 2030. Seems like a really audacious and ambitious goal, and it is, but I think you'll see here in the next slides that we are making really fast progress on this, and there are a lot of private folks who are really excited about some of the projects that we're working on. And all of a sudden the team, whereas, you know, when we set this goal 2 years ago, we thought that it was, you know, a little bit of a stretch goal. We're now feeling like this is very much within reach and that we will be able to increase this here in the next several years. So if I can get into some of the specific projects, just to give you a little bit of flavor of the kinds of projects we're talking about. The two of our companies that went through our program this last year, the community of Shignac in Alaska had an RFP for some storage and solar installation. And if you follow this space, you'll know that oftentimes these RFPs in small communities might have one bidder or two. This year, the Shignac project had, I think, ended up with four bids. And I think three out of the four were either led by our companies or had our companies on the bidding team. And the successful company that won the project was Blue Planet Energy, which is backed up by Ejido. And they were able to secure the first solar and storage power purchase agreement in Alaska, which is a really exciting kind of milestone for the whole state. And it's going into an ABEC community. Next slide. We also, just a kind of overview here, some of this is not quite public information yet, but we can talk about it in broad terms. So the municipality of Anchorage has a climate action plan, and one of our companies, Dynamex, is helping them deploy their climate action plan, a really exciting contract that they secured with the municipality. Tecominco is working with a biomass controls, which is kind of a technology to capture and treat waste water and do kind of a combined heat and power solution. And then in Homer, there's a Alaska's only privately owned section of beach there on the Homer Spit. Shorelock is a company that has a plant-based, it's almost like a glue that helps seal the shore in place to prevent coastal erosion. So this is a really important pilot project for Alaska for obvious reasons, given the amount of coastal erosion in the state. And so one of our companies is tied into a project there with on the Homer Spit. Next slide. So I spoke a little bit about our innovation partnerships, which are these partnerships where we're working with some of Alaska's infrastructure owners to help them think through their hardest problems. Next slide. So one project we can talk publicly about, which I'm really excited about, at the Port of Alaska. The Port of Alaska is perhaps the piece of critical infrastructure for the state. I think 80% of goods in the state come through the port, including fuel and critical materials for our military. The Port of Alaska has engaged us to help them think through how they can become an islanded microgrid in the event of some sort of an earthquake or an interruption to the civilian power grid, and also to help them stabilize and reduce power costs. So we are an innovation partner to the Port of Alaska to help them with all aspects of establishing themselves as a microgrid so that they can stay on if the rest of the grid goes out. Next slide.
Mr. Vandenberg, this is Representative Hopkins on that. With the new designs coming forward for the Port of Anchorage, are those efforts included in that design redo for the port?
So there are several projects at the port that are working simultaneously. This one is focused exclusively on creating some storage backup, a solar array, and adding a couple of circuits between the Port of Alaska and the civilian grid, or the Chugach electric grid, to allow basically the port to flip the switch. But there are other larger long-term port renovation projects that are separate from this scope. It's an entirely separate scope. That answers your question.
It does. Thank you.
Yeah. So if we just talk kind of looking behind the curtains here, what's really going on when we have this innovation partnership with the Port of Alaska? Well, below the line there, you can see that several of our portfolio companies are, you know, who are led by some of the brightest minds, frankly, in the U.S. and globally, really. They are helping us help the port think through their solutions. So I mentioned Dynamex earlier, a software company that helps create long-term kind of climate plans and decarbonization plans. Signal is a behavioral economic firm that helps change user behavior through a pro-social incentive program. Vecta is a group that does financial modeling and microgrid modeling and wraps it all into one platform so you can do basically packaging of projects for private investment. I could go on and on about these companies, but you can see that having these companies staring at the same problems that some of Alaska's critical infrastructure owners are trying to solve is a boon for Alaska, because you have these bright minds and folks who, you know, have spent their entire careers solving some specific problem, suddenly partnering up with infrastructure owners. Next slide. So another example of an innovation partnership is a partnership with Nation. Kotzebue had set a goal of getting to 50% diesel off. We are working with them and have signed a an innovation partnership with them to think about getting to 100% diesel off over the next couple of decades. And that includes, if we go to the next slide, again, a bunch of our companies are part of that plan. So helping 60 Hertz is actually an Alaska-grown company there that does microgrid maintenance and controls. It's a software platform. GreenSpark is a graduate of UAF that has a basically remote servers that sit next to electricity generation infrastructure to reduce the cloud computing cost for folks in distributed communities. So again, with this partnership with Kotzebue Electric, we have our own expertise to lend, but we're also incorporating a bunch of these companies on that project itself. And that project is very exciting, and there's several different federal agencies that are involved in it. And we're also working closely with some large global infrastructure funds who would like to see that project as it's packaged and matured. Next slide. Sorry, I'm going so fast here. Just wanted to leave time for questions at the end.
Oh, it's all right, Mr. Vandenberg. You're going at a decent pace. We're following along. But Representative Drummond does have a question.
Thank you very much, Mr. Vandenberg. I missed what you said. You used a phrase that I couldn't quite understand. Diesel off, was it?
Yep, exactly. So, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I didn't hear the phrase, and I don't know if I caught it correctly.
Yeah, so diesel off. So what... This kind of macro trend that I talked about on the first slides, where there's a global move towards decarbonization and electrification of everything. What we're finding is the large infrastructure players and utilities and municipalities are looking to reduce cost and improve resilience, and are looking for ways to reduce their reliance on diesel and fossil fuels of all sorts. And this is driven by technology, by economics, and also by some public pressure around climate change. And so what we are doing is, when there are asset owners who have said, we see the writing on the wall, we see the need to move and to act quickly, we don't know where to start, we are helping them think through their plans and helping them create economic pathways forward to reduce their reliance on diesel and other expensive energy forms. So that's the phrase diesel off.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and so we track closely our impact. If you go to our website, this is hyperlinked. on the slide deck, but I don't think I'm able to access it here. We actually have a full website now that was just released in the last couple of weeks dedicated to impact. It's just launchalaska.com/impact, I believe, where you can see all of the information we're gathering, not only on the innovation partnerships that we're doing, but we're also supporting our portfolio of companies to help them develop their own impact measurements, which is very cutting edge. I think the Alaska can be proud that we are leading the way here. As we've developed our own impact reporting program, we're talking to some of the largest OEMs and corporates in the world about how they're doing it. And I can tell you that everyone is thinking through this together and is trying to figure out how to do this in a reliable and trustworthy way. But the numbers that we're producing, if you'd have looked at this report 3 years ago, it would have been mostly zeros. But now that we have numbers that are starting to be not zeros, it's really exciting. We're really proud of the impact that that we're measuring on environmental, social, and governance grounds. So I encourage you to go to that website and look through it and dive into some of the specific stories there. And then next slide. So I just wanted to thank members of this committee and members of the legislature in general. There is a bill, Senate Bill 123, which is the one to form a electricity reliability organization on the rail belt. The rulemaking process of that is moving forward with the RCA, and I would encourage members of the legislature to ensure that that rulemaking process continues as planned and isn't delayed. Those of us who have been wanting to work with some of these exciting companies have been waiting for years, and I think you could argue folks on the rail belt have been waiting for 40 years for this this ERO to be established, and everything is in place now. Getting the rulemaking process moving forward and done by July is very feasible. And I wanted to thank you for that, SB 123, and encourage you to ensure that it moves forward and that it is not delayed any further. The reason that's important to us is, you know, we have 21 companies in our portfolio right now. In the next week, we'll announce the next 10. So we'll have 31 companies in our portfolio. They all spend a lot of time in Alaska. Five of them are from Alaska, and they are hyper tuned into our regulatory environment and the signals that we are sending in terms of, are we embracing our role as leaders in energy transition? And this issue of having a single point of negotiation with all the rail belt utilities to allow for resiliency, you know, single interconnection standards, you know, region-wide cybersecurity. This is a big signal to companies about whether or not we're serious and open to doing business with some of the most exciting innovative tech firms. So that bill and the, it moving forward has a material impact on our ability to recruit and work with exciting startup companies.
Mr. Vandenberg,
thank you for your work on.
Certainly. Before you get on there, I think we'll have some questions on Senate Bill 123 and how that works. Representative Hannon had a question.
Well, thank you. Through the chair, and so I guess since he's referring to it as a Senate bill, are we still talking about it, the bill that we passed last session? So it's no longer a Senate bill.
That's correct, Representative Hannon. That would be the what's in front of the RCA now.
All right. And is there some indication, Mr. Chairman, or perhaps Representative, that the rulemaking process is not on track to be fully implemented by July?
At this point, Representative Hannon, there's some concerns that it might be delayed because of discussions between the utilities and the RCA about exactly the structure of that board and who's going to be on that ERO, the Electric Reliability Operative, who's going to have a seat, who's going to have a voting right, things like that. So there has been some discussion about delaying it a little bit to make sure that those discussions can continue. But at this point, I don't think the RCA is delaying it, but trying to get to that implementation date by July 1st for it, assuming they have enough support from the Department of Law for the research that they need. If nobody applies under those regulations that should be done by July 1st, then starting October of this year, the Regulatory Commission would then create their own ERO and their own governance board to move forward quickly.
Okay, thank you.
Certainly. Mr. Vanderberg, on that effort, have you or any of your companies that are interested in seeing the ERO move forward sent in comments to the RCA, urging them to continue or making any comments on what that governance structure would look like?
So we are, two of our companies are submitting comments today, as well as us. And then on the entire rulemaking process, so that's in relationship to the recent request by the utilities to delay the rulemaking process. And we are urging the RCA to deny the request for delay. But then our entire portfolio of companies are aware of the rulemaking process as a whole and are planning on submitting comments 2 weeks from now. And so we're working with them to weigh in on this topic. And it's important. It's important for us and the work that we're trying to do.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for weighing in on that as well with the RCA. I know that Senate Bill 123 and the structure that it proposed was unanimously supported by all of the utilities, the Independent Power Producing Association, the Renewable Energy Project, and you can see a number of the efforts, organizations in the next couple slides who are strong advocates for that bill moving forward, because like you said, we've been waiting 40 years for them to work together.
Yep, 100% agree. Okay, and then also just wanted to thank you for work on the Green Bank and any the ability to capitalize that green bank will open up opportunities for companies to deploy some just really very straightforward energy efficiency and region-wide upgrades to buildings. And it's just a great, the time is right, the technologies are there, this creates jobs, saves money. It's really a straightforward thing, and we encourage you to consider helping to capitalize the green bank. And then the last kind of thing that I would ask is we recently helped a Alaska company that's developing the state's first utility scale solar array. This isn't totally public yet, but what I can tell you is that part of our role was connecting the Alaska company, the Alaska solar developer, with a tax equity investor. As part of those conversations, the negotiation with utilities has been great, it's been positive, and yet there isn't a real incentive in Alaska for utilities to build out renewable generation. And I would encourage this body to consider supporting some sort of renewable portfolio standard for the state so that there's a real incentive for utilities throughout the state to build out their renewable generation. And I think if you do that, again, the number of companies, investors, public and private investors will come flowing in. There's a lot of money out there wanting to be spent. And if the state sets up some kind of an RPS, which I think at this point 40 other states have done so far, this will really send a signal that Alaska is open for business and we're leading the way to modernizing our energy infrastructure in the state. Okay, and so next slide. Our organization is a nonprofit funded primarily by the Department of Navy, Office of Naval Research, and the National Renewable Energy Lab, although we now create a significant part of our budget from project revenues and some of those innovation partnerships that I mentioned. And so we are working hard to make sure that only a small fraction of our budget comes from public dollars. And then we have several organizations that we work with that are critical to us getting our mission done. And you'll see names you recognize on here. That top group of REAP, ASEP, and DEI are all funded through the Office of Naval Research, and we all work together on establishing Alaska as a world-class deployment ground for energy transition technologies. And I can be reached at isaac@launchalaska.com. Thank you so much for your time, and sorry to go to the wire here.
Not a problem at all. Thank you very much, Mr. Vanderberg. found that very interesting and timely as well with the implementation of Senate Bill 123. And if there's no questions for the closure of that presentation, I want to go ahead and thank all of our presenters today for coming to us and making themselves available for questions and to educate us on the committee. At this point, we are not planning on having any committee hearings next week, but hopefully the week after that we will. We'll keep you abreast as members of the committee of what's going to be happening. So if there's no further business at this point, the committee will go ahead and adjourn at 12:31 p.m. Thanks, everybody.